Rising seas and the growing intensity of storms, not just a problem for people living on the coast. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Climate change is also a national security challenge here in the U.S. and abroad. We're going to talk with a former vice admiral who views the changing climate as much of a threat as any rogue nation. Also, Leonard Pitts Jr. is not shy about going after politicians for their stances on different issues. He's currently in a Twitter spat with Senator Marco Rubio. The Pulitzer Prize winner joins us to talk about a life challenging readers on race, politics, and pop culture. And finally, the production of Mozart's Magic Flute performed with a unique Miami backdrop. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for tuning in, I should say. Leonard Pitts Jr. has been revered and detested by readers for years. He's a national columnist. You can read his work in the Miami Herald. He's the 2004 Pulitzer Prize winner, and he's written numerous novels and works of nonfiction. And he's worked in radio, too. He's challenged people from all walks of life, and he continues to challenge the problems of racism in our society. And he joins us now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., Mr. Pitts, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it is my pleasure to be here.
I'm going to start with, you know, because I talk about, you know, some of the challenges that you've brought on to other people, you know, in your columns. And you're in a current spat, maybe, if that's what we call it, with Senator Marco Rubio. This started with a column that you wrote. I believe it's the one, "To Be Blunt, Shania, your comment backing Trump was really dumb." Remind us of Shania Twain's comments and what they illustrate about American politics.
She said that she voted for Trump, and I don't have her exact quote in front of me, but the part that really kind of set me off was that she said that because he seemed honest. And of all the things that Mr. Trump seems, I think it's objectively true that he does not seem honest. The column went from there, and it just sort of spoke about the fact that I've reached a point where I find it fruitless and counterproductive to try to have reasoned arguments and engagements with people who support President or support Mr. Trump, because frequently what they're identifying as facts are not in fact factual, and it's almost as if we're drawing, you know, one of us is drawing facts from what's going on in the world, and others are drawing facts from this alternate reality, and it's just a useless exercise. That's what seemed to set the senator off.
And she's, of course, Shania Twain is Canadian, so she wouldn't have voted in this election. But, you know, so the Senator Rubio responded in a tweet, and it went like this, quote, "This well-known national writer states very clearly that the 63 million Americans who voted for Trump are haters who should not be heard from or engaged in dialogue. It's a view widely held by many elites on the left, but very few of them so openly admit to it." Now, you came back with a column asking him, what does he stand for? Do you find yourself regularly in feuds with politicians?
I have never found myself in a feud with a politician, although I did get an upset phone call once from Jeb Bush, probably about 20 years ago. But other than that, politicians tend to ignore me, which is, you know, par for the course and as it should be. So I was a little bit surprised that he, one, engaged on Twitter, and then after that second column appeared, we had pretty much a night-long back and forth on Twitter, he and I, about his claims that Trump supporters sort of held their noses and voted for Mr. Trump despite his bigotry and misogyny. And the facts actually show otherwise, and I kept making that point to him.
What do you think about the fact that we now live in a world? I mean, look, a long time ago, you'd write a column about a politician, and they may go on TV and respond to it, but now, as you said, you can go all night with a politician or anybody on Twitter, and they're going to go back and forth with you. I mean, does that sort of conversation, is that good for political debate? Or, I mean, what do you think about the fact that you can do that now on social media?
I don't know that it's necessarily productive to be going back and forth with one another, particularly from his end as a public servant, to be going back and forth at one another in 280 character bytes. As one observer of the Twitter storm or tweet storm or whatever pointed out, shouldn't he be, aren't there things that he needs to be doing for his constituents? It just seemed kind of conspicuously, I don't know, bizarre, I guess, that he had time to essentially engage me in tweets for a night. The last tweet was from him. I found it in the morning after I'd gone to bed. It was 12:14 in the morning. And it's, you know, it's like, okay, aren't there better things that we could be doing? I mean, maybe not me. All I was missing was, you know, some stuff I had on the DVR. But he's a United States senator, so you'd think that maybe there were more important things for him.
And then, of course, we look at, you know, after that, you did have another column again asking him. We still haven't answered me, Senator, but, you know, and we're going to reach out to him. We've wanted him on the program as well, not just to ask about this, but a lot of other things. You know, one of the other columns, too, and because we talk about the president, we talk about his supporters, you challenge this idea of trying to talk to Trump supporters. And I wanted to just, you know, ask you, I don't have a Trump supporter here, so I'm going to have to speak for them and say, look, not all of them are bigots, right? They're not all racist. They're not all bad people. I mean, I know people who voted for Trump. They're not that. Isn't it a mistake to not try to talk to people and see the differences and see where maybe we can meet eye to eye on stuff?
I'm an African-American man. I can't meet eye to eye with bigotry. And here's the thing. Here's the problem with the characterization that you give about, you know, the Trump supporter who is not a bigot. And it's the same question that I asked the senator that he could not or would not answer. What is the difference? What is the functional difference between being a bigot and voting for one? If I, as an African-American man, if you come approached me and said to me, Leonard, you know, I'm non-racist, I'm anti-racist, I'm with African-American people and all their aspirations for equal rights, but it's a 19, I believe it is 80, thereabout, I'm going to go vote for David Duke for the Louisiana governor. You know, what weight do your claims of non-bigotry have with me?
Let me bring it to you this way. I think I've been thinking about this, and I think about some of my family members I know who voted for the president, and I know that they're not. But how about this? Is it possible that we live in a world where you're only part of Team Red or Team Blue, and you have no choice? You're part of the team. You have to vote for that team. There were people who didn't vote for Trump in the primaries. They didn't like him. But then once he became their candidate, they could never see themselves voting for the other side. Is it possible that we've just now live in a world where it's just blue and red and you got to stick with your side no matter what?
I understand why it's difficult to characterize the bulk of Trump supporters in the way that I have, especially for those who, unlike me, have family members and or friends or acquaintances who voted for Mr. Trump. It's kind of easy for me because I have none of that. But the facts are what the facts are. The studies that I've cited, and I've seen three at this point, all point to the same thing. Initially, a lot of journalists, myself included, were saying that this was economic insecurity. But economic insecurity does not explain it all. In the first place, if it was economic insecurity, who's more economically insecure than African Americans and a lot of Latino Americans who would have been Mr. Trump's first voter? So that doesn't wash. Secondly, the researchers found that the people who voted for Trump, the people who voted most enthusiastically for Trump, his bigotry was not something they had to get over. It was the thing that attracted them. If all they had wanted was a return to Republican political policies, then they had their choice of Jeb Bush, Carly Fiorina, Senator Rubio. They had, Lord knows, they had lots of choices. But for some reason, they gravitated to, I'm talking about Republican primary voters, they gravitated to the voter, to the candidate who described Mexican immigrants as rapists and who had a history of federal housing discrimination lawsuits, and who said that an American judge of Mexican heritage was unfit to judge him, and on and on and on. We have to, before we can deal with or address or hope to resolve the problems that we have in this society, we have to have the courage to face what they are. And I think that where Trump is concerned and the reasons that people seem to have voted for Trump, a lot of us are refusing to do that.
Again, I'm talking with Leonard Pitts, Jr. You can read his column in the Miami Herald. He is the 2004 Pulitzer Prize winner. He's also an author, and he's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Where did your love of writing come from? When did it start for you?
It's funny because people often ask me, when did you decide to be a writer? And I never am able to answer the question because I never did decide to be a writer. I knew that I was a writer when I was 5 years of age. And, I used to tell people that, and I'd see the shocked looks on their faces till I got older and had kids of my own and realized how young five is. But nevertheless, when I was a kid of five, I said that this was what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I wanted to, my greatest hope was not to be like, I believe it's Salieri in the movie Amadeus, to be, to be okay at it, but not really good enough to make any kind of mark. I wanted to be a writer who was good enough that people would want to read them. So, that's probably, outside of my family achievement, that's probably the proudest thing for me in my life, just the fact that, one, I was a writer, but two, that I was a writer that was able to, make some kind of living at this for 42 years.
And when did you realize that writing editorials was your greatest strength?
I don't know that I ever realized it was my greatest strength. I started out trying to, as a novelist. I wrote novels for many years and sent them to publishers, and publishers sent them back. So I spent a lot of years as a music critic, the last four of them for the Miami Herald, and then went on to do the column. So the column is sort of, like the music criticism, it was a thing that I did because I wasn't at that point writing novels.
And you know what? If you've had a successful career as just writing novels, but you've also, like I said, you won the Pulitzer Prize. Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
I thought that would be your greatest strength. But who am I? That's for me to not me to judge. I should say that's for you. What was it like, by the way, when you did get the Pulitzer? We've had a lot of different Pulitzer winners on, and I'm always fascinated by that question of like, is this like the top of the top for you? Is that is that the biggest thing that you can get?
Oh yeah, professionally you don't do any better than to win the Pulitzer as a writer. It was an out of body experience that day. That's what it was like. And I also felt, because people had been predicting Pulitzers for me. People around the Herald newsroom, friends of mine, had been predicting the Pulitzer for so many years, since 1992, and I was a finalist in, I think it was 1993, but didn't get it. And I had really felt like I was letting them down every year when the list came out and my name wasn't on it. So one of the things that I felt, in addition to being, happy and proud or whatever, was also relieved that I was no longer letting down my friends. Hey, I finally got it for us, guys.
As a writer, what is the most important thing for you? What do you want to accomplish with your work? Are you just documenting life for future generations, or are you trying to ignite change?
It depends on the piece of work. I guess at the bottom line, whatever it is that you're doing, the bottom line is that you're trying to communicate something. You're trying to communicate an idea. Certain columns, you're trying to change a mind. You're arguing a point. Certain columns are just primal scream columns. A number of my columns about Donald Trump have probably fallen into that category, where there's just a need to vent. Vent your head and frankly vent on behalf of a lot of other people. And there's observational columns, there's softer columns. I did a piece on looking at the moon, I guess it's about 3-4 weeks ago for the Herald, which was a nice change of, it was a change of pace for the readers, but frankly it was also a nice change of pace for me to be able to just write about something that had nothing to do with race, culture, politics, gender identity, or any of the other touchstones of division that we have in this country.
But I'm glad that you brought that up. I do want to get to that, because that was a lovely article in that it was a change of pace. And I wanted to ask you about this project these two filmmakers were doing. But before that, though, as a writer as well, you have to deal with hate from your readers, from your critics. Do you remember the first time you ever got a letter from a reader just wanting to rip you apart?
Not the first time. I remember some of the more memorable ones. But that dates back to, me saying mean things about Michael Bolton and Neil Diamond in the 90s for the Miami Herald, and probably even before that. So, I get a lot of hate now, but there's a certain special quality to the hate of an affronted Michael Bolton fan that that you're going to find it hard to equal anywhere else.
I'm going to have to go back and find that, because I'm trying to figure out, well, I guess what that hate could be for Michael Bolton. But anyway, I mean, look, one of the things that changed, obviously, is that people used to have to write a letter to a newspaper. Right. Now people are just tweeting you. They're waiting for you to tweet, and then they're just responding, and they're throwing the hate. One of the things that's interesting reading your Twitter feed is how you handle that. Is that something you learn over time, or is that just your natural way of dealing with critics?
I guess it's natural. I never thought it was anything special, but people keep telling me about my Twitter feed, and I'm going to have to go back and look and see what it is that I'm doing. But essentially, I give back what I perceive to be what I perceive the readers to be giving me. If it's something thoughtful, I'll try to be thoughtful in return. If it's something snarky and nasty, well, I've got that gear. I think I explained to somebody on Twitter once that, you know, I'm a black guy who grew up playing the dozens in South L.A. So if it's just going to be a game of insults, you know, you're gonna I'm pretty well armed for that. So let's not do that. Let's try to do something else. But if you want to do that, you know, here I am.
Have you ever come across somebody who commented and said something that just jolted you and you didn't even want to respond?
I suppose nothing specific comes to mind, but I'm sure that's happened. People have said, you know, people have said all sorts of things. It's reached a point now. I've been doing this column for 24 years now, that it's really difficult to surprise me. I seldom read something that I have not read before. I'm seldom called something that I have not been called before. But, you know, there's always that one that sort of jumps out at you. There's also always that one that's, you know, on the positive side. There was a reader some years back who told me about how he asked me a question, something about race that he thought was original and really incisive and would really sort of, you know, knock me on my heels. And I apparently got a very tired look on my face and answered the question for him, because it was something that I'd answered many times before. And he said that he had been very disappointed, you know, by the answer. But then he thought about it and lived some. And 10 years later, it seen some things that it caused him to understand not only that I was right, but that the understanding that he'd had when he'd asked the question was entirely mistaken. So he thanked me for, one, being patient enough to answer his question, and two, for you know, sort of, I guess, enlightening him or whatever. And that, you know, that doesn't happen often, you know, it's very seldom, but when it does, it feels good.
You know, looking at your columns, your books, speeches mm-hmm. that you make across the country, again, the big issue you keep coming back to, you've talked about here today, is obviously the issue of race. It is a big, important mm-hmm. issue, and something that has really been brought more to the center stage in the last couple of years. But, you know, I know this is a big question, but what is your take on why there's this growing fear of brown and black people that's so virulent now in the 21st century? Why? Why haven't we grown past this?
Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, I think that those of us who were beneficiaries of the civil rights movement really failed to keep our eyes on the prize, took our foot off the accelerator, whatever analogy that you want to use. But I think that we became happy, quote unquote, with progress and assumed that progress was permanent and forever. And I forget who said it. It might have been Thomas Jefferson. I may be wrong, but I love the quote, "Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty." And that's something that we are relearning. But I think that in a more immediate sense, what we are seeing in this country is the result is an upheaval as a result of the fact that, as the Census Bureau keeps telling us, by the year 2040, this will no longer be a majority white country. It will no longer be a majority anybody country. All of us will be minorities. And I think that that sense of upheaval is what is leading to this sort of panic response on the part of some of those who have always enjoyed majority status and are you know, terrified at the idea that they are now going to be relegated to the minority. I think that's what a lot of the response to Barack Obama was about. A lot of the really over-the-top, overheated, disengaged from reality response to Barack Obama wasn't about anything that he said or did or was, except for the fact that he was the first African-American president. And a lot of people looked at that and knew what time it was in terms of American demographics and became positively terrified.
This allows me to come back to this. I wanted to come back to this column you wrote recently about mm-hmm. this film, because what I took from it was this, is that, you know what, even with all of these differences and all of our issues and problems, one simple thing could get us all to stop for a moment and just forget about it and think about something else. You talked about these two filmmakers, Wiley Overstreet and Alex Garosh, and they did this film with a telescope and challenging people to look up at the moon. Just briefly, what was that about? That was really interesting.
I don't know if you've seen the film. It was a really beautiful little film they did, about 3.5 minutes. They traveled around L.A., and they asked people to look in the telescope and look at the moon. And actually, they didn't even ask people. They were just there, and people come up to them and say, "What's that?" Because it's a telescope, and it's an odd-looking thing for those of us who have no idea what a telescope actually looks like. It's a very odd-looking contraption, and people come up to them and want to look at it, and then everybody's amazed. Everybody says the same thing, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God," at the closeness and the nearness of the moon. And it just... the point that I was making there is that sometimes we all, I include myself in that, we all get so entrapped in looking down into the detritus of our own lives, into the differences that exist between us, both real and superficial, into our own problems and the stuff that we deal with, that we forget sometimes to look up and to look out from ourselves. And I thought that movie was a great way of making that point in a non-preachy and maybe even non-obvious way.
Well, the column was lovely, but that definitely movie I'd like to check out, no question. I've been talking again with Leonard Pitts Jr., the 2004 Pulitzer Prize winner, author, columnist. He's done a little bit of everything, I think. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Mr. Pitts, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
All right, still to come on the program, climate change as a national security problem. That's up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, climate change is a threat to national security. It's a growing concern for the military, including Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who has argued climate change is already impacting global stability. Included in that belief is retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn. Gunn served in the U.S. Navy for 35 years. Gunn is on the board of directors of the American Security Project, a nonpartisan organization whose mission is to educate the public about the changing nature of national security in the 21st century. He recently spoke to us as part of our project, The Invading Sea, an editorial collaboration to urge action on sea level rise between WLRN, the Miami Herald, the Palm Beach Post, and the Sun Sentinel.
The U.S. military has been called upon historically to do the nation's business around the world. That is, the military, among other things, being an instrument of humanitarian work and the like, but among other things, is intended to and has done well at executing the mission of ensuring security around the world for the flow of commerce, for the welfare of people, so that migrations are avoided, so that mass famines can be avoided. The change in the climate, the unexpected conditions that people around the world are facing, contribute in a variety of ways to the stresses that failed states and failing states have already in providing the services necessary for their people.
We think about one as an example. I didn't think about this. One former military leader had told me, well, look at Syria as an example. And we think of it as the civil war and ISIS is there and a lot of different countries are involved. But really, a lot of this started because of intense droughts brought on by climate change and people having to migrate within their country.
Exactly. The government of Syria, which 10 years, 12 years ago, would not have been considered to be one of the failing states in the world, was nevertheless having difficulty providing services to its citizens in its big cities. And then a prolonged drought, 7 years or more, coupled with some failures of product in Russia and elsewhere that raised the price of bread in particular and contributed to the Arab Spring. In Syria, the drought drove something like 1.5 million farmers off of their property and into the cities where the government, as I said before, was already having difficulty providing services. So the stresses that already were there between the people and their dictatorial government were aggravated by the conditions that they found due to climate change. There's no doubt that the drought was one of the consequences of a changing climate.
All right, Admiral, let's talk about our military bases and national security. Coming back to this country, I mean, we have bases, the U.S. has bases all over the world. when you look at here in the United States, here in Florida, we have the Florida Naval Air Station in Key West. We used to have a base in Homestead. What do you see as some of the challenges that these bases are going to face? What's the threat to them?
This is really an important factor, Lewis, in national security. The base structure of the United States military is absolutely essential to the generation of readiness. The fact is, when we send forces to do the nation's work, they come from places where they've had the opportunity to train, to rest and recover from previous operations, to be recruited, to be equipped. Those stateside bases are invariably, we think, under threat from the consequences of climate change. If you look at the East Coast of the United States and the Gulf Coast, the Union of Concerned Scientists several months ago produced a report that said 18 U.S. military installations, not just Navy, but Air Force, Army, and Marines as well, were threatened by sea level rise. There have been conditions brought about by the change in climate across the country that have degraded America's military's ability to train. For example, in the West, wildfires and brush fires have been far more common, and the season has been longer. As a matter of fact, in some places, the fire season is now almost a year long, where it used to be just several months. The use of live weapons in those areas in training has been severely restricted. Here in South Florida, the time that the base commanders have to devote, understandably, to contending with the new challenges of a changing climate and a rising sea will be time that has to be taken away from other essential military functions.
So it sounds like, I mean, bases now have to consider resiliency the same way that cities, like the cities of South Florida, have to. Is how do we build up to the oncoming rising sea level or these other factors you mentioned?
Well, the bases as a group have undertaken this challenge. I think for every service, I'm most familiar with the Navy, but the Naval Installations Command, which oversees all of the Navy installations worldwide, has undertaken a resilience program. And it encompasses not only that part of the base that's inside the fence line, but it's also intended to be collaborative, cooperative with the surrounding community, so that the steps that are taken to improve the resilience of the base itself to as well produce its own power when that's a piece of the strategy that needs to be implemented to improve resilience, where the benefits of that can be shared with the surrounding community, because after all, it is one organization, and the people who surround these bases are very much supportive of the military's mission for generating readiness.
And we talk about, you know, these weather systems that are impacted by climate change, hurricanes, of course.
Sure.
As we come upon hurricane season again, I talked about Homestead Air Force Base 25 years ago, decimated like much of Homestead, much of South Florida because of Hurricane Andrew. It's now an Air Reserve base. How have the bases of any of the branches adapted in the Gulf Coast area and along the eastern seaboard to hurricanes, as we've seen more hurricanes now earlier and later in the season? Not so much more storms, but more intense storms. Now they're moving further north than before.
Sure. Well, there are new construction standards, as you might expect. And so when new things are being built, they're being built with a greater threat from hurricanes in mind. It's not just true on the East Coast, but it's true on the West Coast too. And some of the most severe hits from hurricanes have been encountered in Hawaii, and certainly the Western Pacific bases, America's installations in Okinawa and mainland Japan, the Philippines, elsewhere, have all been hardened in some ways to confront the challenges of hurricanes. But the bases in South Florida face the same challenges as these municipalities, as the cities and county in South Florida. And so what I saw over the last couple of days when I've had the privilege of talking with citizens here who are involved, who are thinking ahead about what South Florida faces, I've been impressed by the collaborative effort. And I know that what's being learned by the municipalities and the civic leaders in South Florida is being shared with the bases as well, and vice versa. I know the bases are encouraged to do that too.
I'd imagine every base is a target to any enemy, so there has to be some level of protection or preparation for an attack. How do leaders look at storms and, again, rising seas and, again, all of these other natural challenges that you're going to face that are getting worse and worse? Do you view them as the same kind of level threat as an enemy?
It's definitely another foe. And it requires depth of preparation. You know, in many cases, one of the great aspects of preparing for the onslaught of extremes of weather contribute to hardening the base in a physical security sense with regard to other threats, too. So anti-swimmer, looking at these things from a Navy point of view, the anti-swimmer and limpet mine threat and the like, ensuring that you have greater control over the ocean area that is important to you as a naval base commander, or the surrounding area and the airspace if you're an air base commander, in order to be not only aware of what is going on at the time of the onslaught of a storm, but using those same mechanisms to determine what's going on in your airspace or sea space when there's a potential attack. All that stuff works very nicely together.
You think about, again, what the military has to do after when it deals with a storm, really what happens after a storm, or, again, these migrations that may occur because of droughts or, again, excessive rainfall, flooding, and so forth. I look at some cases in particular. I mean, we had Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Katrina. There was Hurricane Maria recently in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And again, the Navy had to be involved in these helping these areas afterwards in the crisis. Have you seen a change over the years in the involvement and that level of involvement after massive storms or any natural disaster? And what kind of, I guess, what toll does that take on our, again, preparedness?
Sure. A number of us, let me go back a couple of years. A number of us for several years have been talking about the importance of recognizing that humanitarian assistance and disaster relief is an actual mission of the U.S. Armed Forces. For decades, it was considered that during the Cold War, if you were capable of going toe-to-toe with the Soviets, that you would naturally have developed all the capability that would be necessary in terms of assisting in the event of a natural disaster. And we demonstrated that around the world often, and at home as well. And at home, of course, the Guard is an extraordinarily valuable and powerful resource in helping in that way. And they've proven that they can function very effectively around the world as ambassadors of the United States in humanitarian assistance, too. And they've done that shoulder to shoulder with the other members of the armed forces.
So these kind of missions, again, where you're going in to help and assist an area, community, a geographical region that's been impacted, do you see these missions increasing in volume?
I do.
So again, the climate change is changing so much right now. It's happening right now, and it's forcing the military now to stretch itself out even more.
That is absolutely the way I see it. You're right on. You know, we talk about climate change in terms of average temperature increases, but I think what the military is seeing, certainly what I'm seeing in military operations, is increases in the necessity of response far out of proportion to the relatively small increases in average temperature that we've experienced so far. And that's because the average, of course, is the result of the extremes. You've got a greater storm intensity and frequency. You've got greater episodes of cold in the Arctic this last winter. There were several days when the temperature was above freezing. It hasn't happened in recorded history before. And so it's not only extreme heat, it's not only extreme storms, it's not only extreme cold, but they result in each one of those has its own challenges.
Again, I'm talking with retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn. He served in the U.S. Navy for 35 years. He is on the board of directors of the American Security Project. It's a nonpartisan organization whose mission is to educate the public about the changing nature of national security in the 21st century. And he's been giving talks about national security threats, of course, impacted by climate change. So what do you think about, you're looking at this from, again, from that a very interesting perspective, but you also have seen how this topic has been politicized and it is polarizing and it is debated over and over again on television and with politicians. So, I mean, what do you think when you see that and how do you maneuver through those kind of conversations?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's a horrible waste of time to argue about these things. I think that the science is absolutely conclusive. I understand that there are some people who don't see it that way. But the way I look at this, Lewis, is what's the cost of being wrong? I mean, suppose you adopt my position and say that not only is the climate changing, but humans are some or most or maybe all of the reason that it's changing this fast. And we do something about it. We not only adapt to the extent we're able, we establish seawalls, we rebuild the natural defenses against the sea in areas where they've been eroded. We do all those appropriate things. And then, at the same time, we transition and maybe even lead the world, as we should, in a transition to advanced energy. Now, sure, I think transitioning to advanced energy is going to have tremendous benefits in mitigation. I think reducing our carbon footprint is very important. That's not the only reason to transition or lead a transition to advanced energy.
So you're saying, your argument is, as many, it's like, well, if we do it our way, but if we're wrong, still there are advances and advantages to
right.
it. Okay, how about this? I mean, our Commander-in-Chief, President Trump, has consistently denied climate change. He even called it a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. How does this steadfast position by the highest levels of office directly impact the efforts that you've been telling me about by the military? Your commander-in-chief isn't buying into it the way you are.
I got it. You know, one of the great things about our democracy, Lewis, is I don't have to agree with anybody. I don't have to agree with the president. And since I'm no longer in uniform, I can even say I don't agree with the president. The military is taking, I think, prudent steps to ensure that it is fit to fight. And that means we have to, going back to the naval installations, the Army air bases, I mean, the Army bases, air stations, and the like, that we have to protect those because they are the places where readiness for the American forces is generated. We have to build our relationships with communities. We talked about that earlier, because that contributes to the base's readiness to do its work. But it also, in my estimation, has a favorable, very favorable impact on both adaptation and mitigation for climate change. Those are things that, fortunately, Secretary Mattis sees as a military necessity. The other commanders in the Defense Department do as well. And, you know, truth be told, the administration appears to have given the services latitude to do that. And I think that's the right thing to do. And South Florida is not without controversy, but the Army has seen the need, for example, to examine the technologies associated with small modular nuclear reactors. If we look back at our experience in Afghanistan to this point, where we lost, the most dangerous thing soldiers and Marines could do was escort a convoy. Convoys were 85, 90% liquid. They were carrying mostly fuel and some water. The most exposure to risk that we gave to our soldiers and Marines was moving fuel. If we could put a small modular nuclear reactor in a forward area and provide power there, we would reduce the risk to our soldiers and Marines. And so on the front lines, the services are talking about moving in that direction. At home, the other ways of generating power, fuel cell, electrical generation, solar, wind, all of those things we believe play a role. And leading by example, as well as investing in research and development and being welcoming to new technologies for the generation of electricity and for the reduction of carbon, I think are both positive examples.
Well, that was retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn from the American Security Project discussing the threats to national security posed by climate change. You can read excerpts from the interview and more of our climate change coverage by visiting WLRN.org. Well, still to come, a new translation of a Mozart piece performed with a unique South Florida backdrop. That's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You're listening to Orchestra Miami at their dress rehearsal last night. Orchestra Miami's production of Mozart's The Magic Flute, a fairy tale told through opera. It follows Prince Tamino on his journey to save the captured princess Pamina. Now, the play offers a new English translation by stage director David Grabargiewicz, and it will be held at the Scottish Rite Temple May 11th through the 13th. And we have photos, by the way, on our Facebook page and Twitter page. Just look up WLRN Sundial, a magnificent space. In the studio with me now is David, also actor Gabriel Pricer. Pricer plays one of the lead roles. He's a bird catcher who helps the prince in his quest. David, Gabe, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You know what, Gabriel, real quickly, explain the premise of The Magic Flute for those unfamiliar with the show.
Well, quite appropriately, it is about the Mason rites, and we are doing it in a Mason temple right here in Miami. Tamino and encounters Papageno, the bird catcher, the part that I play early on, and they journey together. It's kind of like the Star Wars before Star Wars, you know? and they're going to rescue the princess, Pamina, supposedly has been kidnapped. But before they can get to the princess, they have to go through all these trials at the temple, and Zarathustra is the head guy, who's kind of like Darth Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi wrapped in one, because you can't tell if he's good or bad until until about halfway through. But, you know, long story short, they prevail, and they're able to rescue the princess with some great music in between. You have the Queen of the Night aria that everyone knows with the high F, and just some really top-notch music, and Orchestra Miami sounds fabulous, so it's a pleasure to be here with them.
No Wookiees, no Millennium Falcon, though.
There's a bird catcher, so I guess I'm Chewbacca and Han Solo, maybe wrapped in one.
Okay, there's a visual for you. David, why'd you want to translate the play from its original German?
Well, I think that the whole idea is accessibility, not only for the art form of opera, but for this fantastic tale. You know, it's the magic flute, and for it to sit in a foreign language and for an audience to be able to respond to it in the immediate, which is what the art form of theater is all about, is a trick. And so when I was originally commissioned, which was by the New York City Opera, to do a reduced version for children, I chose to do it in verse form. And so doing it in verse and doing it in English has made it a really hip, really fun, I think, translation that allows us to be sort of Dr. Seussy about it.
And how long did it take to do that translation?
It took almost a year. It's a very long work. It's 3 hours long, and it's in verse from start to finish almost exclusively.
And I want to know from both of you, what's unique about doing this performance at the Scottish Rite Temple?
Something that's very fascinating that I didn't know until first day of rehearsal is they had drops, natural drops, or drops that were native to the temple, their own there. And David can kind of explain a little bit more, but they had over 70 drops, was it, David?
That's true. They had over 70 drops in storage, which they restored, and it was Elaine Rinaldi's vision as artistic director of Orchestra Miami to put this all together for the Magic Flute Opera.
For people who don't know, what is a drop?
That's okay. No. That's a good one.
It is
a stage backdrop. In this case, these are hand-painted works of art that are canvases 35 feet by 25 feet. They're huge.
Yeah.
They would take
They're
up
gorgeous.
The Louvre.
Absolutely gorgeous.
And something else you said, too, because, I mean, the story, so much Freemasonry in Mason, you know, symbols behind it, which is something else that this is a Mason building, right?
So appropriate to do it in their temple. And that's Mozart was a Mason. Schikaneder, who wrote the libretto, wrote the words to Magic Flute and also premiered the role of Papageno in the original. How appropriate he wrote the role for himself. He was an ex-Mason. So there's a lot of symbology in the music and in the text. And obviously it's about the rites, these trials of passage for Tamino and Papageno. So you can't have a more appropriate setting. And it's such a historic building in the middle of downtown Miami.
You know, Orchestra Miami is composed of professional musicians and performers from the region. Gabe, I'll start with you. How long have you been with Orchestra Miami now?
This is my first performance with Orchestra Miami. I know they've been around for 11 years, founded by Elaine. And Elaine is an old friend of mine. We've sung at other places in Orlando. We've done this production once before with David. So I was very excited that she called me down from Orlando to come and sing with her again. She's a very dear friend.
What's it like breaking in as an actor? And you know, especially in opera?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, opera is... is difficult because you can't just, you know, people watch America's Got Talent and they think, oh, I could be Paul Potts and I can just sing Nessun Dorma and start having an opera career. That's not really accurate, unfortunately. Nothing against America's Got Talent. America does have talent. But opera takes a lot of work. You know, you have to go to school, you have to get your undergrad, typically your master's, you have to learn Italian, French, German, sometimes Russian. You have to learn the different styles. You have to allow your voice to develop. So it takes time, and you never know if it's going to pay off. You invest 6 years of training. You invest money in auditions and voice lessons, coachings, and then you just pray, you know, that you still have the talent to make it in the industry. So I consider myself very lucky to have a career doing what I love.
You know, we also heard from one of your co-stars, Keani Richards, and she shared her experience of finding opportunities in opera.
Coming out of grad school, I didn't really have that many opportunities to actually get the experience, because most companies or places are looking for experiences on your resume, but if you can't get the opportunities, where do you look? So I decided to do things on my own, and that progressed into people actually referencing me to other people. And thankfully, Orchestra Miami actually gives me that opportunity to get up on my feet and actually gain that experience and share my gift with everyone.
And by the way, I'm sorry, it's Keani Richardson. My apologies. David, what's it like for you to work with these, you know, young actors and try to help them develop their craft? And you, as he said, you know, as Gabe said, I mean, it's not an easy journey. But what do you do to help them? And what do you tell them?
Well, it's a really special and wonderful process for me. I work as a director, writer, and an educator. And to be able to put people together and ask them to combine the art form of singing and acting together, which is what opera singing is about. In other words, it takes it beyond the level of concert to communicating character and story plot through motion and sound. It's an exciting, thrilling experience. And what we have is actually a panoply of persons coming together in this very large cast. This is one of the earliest musical I know, really, The Magic Flute. It's a huge show with lots of major characters, lots of choristers coming together, a little bit of dance, and showing them how all the different pieces in opera work. Couldn't be more fun.
This show has an interesting prop, a giant snake.
What
you thought I was? You thought I wasn't gonna,
a snake?
I'm not letting you get away without talking about this, David. I mean, describe what they're going to see.
Well, this is pretty amazing. The Asian Cultural Society here in Miami has donated their time and efforts to allow us to use a 100-foot-long puppet snake that we practiced with yesterday and we practiced with today that weaves its way throughout the entire audience before attacking the Prince Tamino. It's so beautiful.
And you know what, by the way, Gabe, by the your character, too, you also go out into the audience, right?
Right. There's several entrances through the audience.
You break the fourth wall often.
Yeah, and that was kind of written in. I mean, he's very much the comedic relief, you know, going back to the Star Wars. He is the Han Solo, like, ah, geez, you know, get this Nerf herder out of the way or whatever. I guess that was Princess Leia who said that. But, yeah, I mean, that was very much the construct of theater, and it still is nowadays with modern-day sitcoms. You know, going back to what David was saying, that opera, it's not this big hairy monster. You know, it's been around for 400 years. But opera is the original music theater. It's the original theater. It's the original TV. It's the original entertainment.
It's the original rock show. It was so electric when people used to go to see it because they didn't hear anything like it.
Okay, so it's the original, all of these things, as you said. But okay, in today's world, where we have all these options for entertainment. So, look, your opera fans, they're coming. But how do you get those who don't think much about opera or don't know enough about opera to get them to understand it's a rock show? Come watch it. What do you do, David? How do you do that?
Well, one of the basic things we've talked about is make sure it's in an accessible language. But I'll tell you this about opera. If you don't know the words, You understand the heart of music. Music has soul, the way jazz has soul, opera music has soul. And if you open your heart and yourself to that, you're going to have an experience.
And real quick, Gabe, yeah, what do you do? How do you convince, you know, and young people too, that opera is a cool thing, besides telling them it's like Star Wars?
Of course. Well, that helps, right? We had 850 second graders this morning watch the show, and they were enthralled the entire time. I just heard that the attention span of the average human is now like 10 seconds because of Google. That's what I heard, so I guess it's true. But these kids were enthralled for 2 hours to watch this, and I think Magic Flute is a perfect piece if you've never been to an opera to come as your first one, because it has dialogue. It functions like a musical, has dance numbers, but then has those vocal fireworks, this lady screaming a high F. I mean, come on.
And it's got a giant snake. And no, it's not Star Wars, even though he said it's kind of like Star Wars.
It kind of is, though.
All right, Gabriel Prysor, again, he plays the lead role, one of the lead roles in the show, Papageno, and also David Grabarkiewicz. He is the director, again, translated this into English from its original German. The show, again, plays, it's a special setting that you've got to check out. It plays May 11th through the 13th. You want to check it out. We have information on our website, WLRN.org. Also, we'll have it up on our Facebook page as well. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That's the program. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back again tomorrow.